Hey Fresh Capital listeners, today Albert and I are doing a more holistic sector overview rather than a single company breakdown. What's interested us is food tech in Asia. With over half the world's population living in Asia, a population that's still growing tremendously, there are many food-related opportunities for companies and investors. Albert and I unpack how consumer habits, businesses, and tech is done differently in relation to food in Asia. Keep listening and enjoy. Welcome to another episode of Fresh Capital. Every week, we provide a refreshingly simple way to learn about companies and investing. My name is Dan. Joining me from a different city this time, Albert. How are you doing?
Dan, I think this might be our first Queensland, New South Wales episode. Very good.
Yes, cross-border episode. I'm in Brisbane. I was attending an Indonesia trade conference on Thursday. It's a lot of fun. And Albert, you've been hustling as usual in Sydney. Anything interesting happened over the last week?
It's just probably business as usual over the past week. Although something exciting has happened. You know, convince someone else to start playing this game that I've been playing.
What game's that?
So it's a game called Polytopia.
Never heard of it.
Yeah, okay. It's like Age Empires. I think we might have talked about this in the pod. I was playing Age Empires for a while. But Polytopia is like a more short-form version of it that is highly addicting.
Interesting. Okay, well, that's Nerd Corner for today. Moving on, Albert, this week's episode, you threw a curveball here. So we're not diving into a specific company, though we will look at a couple of examples. You wanted to explore food in Asia, food tech in Asia. Give us some more context, Albert. What were you thinking? What were the questions you wanted to answer?
Yeah, so thanks for indulging me, Dan. I think earlier this week, the AFR reported that Domino's had acquired a bunch of different stores in the Southeast Asia region, which bring, the total amount of stores they had to, I think, over 2,000 from memory. I don't have the number in front of me. And so I was really curious and I wanted to understand, just surface level, why are Western food chains so popular in Asia? And why aren't Asian food chains, so food chains that originate from like China, Japan, etc., not as popular in countries like Australia and the US. That's kind of where the initial thought started. And then it kind of evolved from there as to like, what are the things they're doing around food and food tech in Asia that we're not necessarily doing or that we don't yet see in countries like Australia and the US. And so that's how we kind of landed at this podcast today.
So one thing I wanted to get straight at the start, Albert, when we say food tech, what are we talking about?
Oh, that's a really, really good question. It's a curveball to define it straight away. I'm going to say just like anything that enables either the creation, delivery, distribution of food and kind of associated things, including things like supply chain, quality assurance, and payments.
Yeah, I think you hit that one out of the park, Albert. Every sort of industry is now getting a tech added to it and it's become very, very hot. So obviously you got fintech, agritech, food tech, every sort of traditional sector that we have is just getting tech thrown on the end of it. And I think it's just a label to cover just innovation in that particular sector. And obviously food has got such a wide range of touch points which can be innovated from. I think in this episode, we're going to be highlighting a few which are particularly distinctive in the Asia region, and we'll try and answer that question of why Western franchises, companies are much more prevalent in Asia than the other way around. And I think this does actually bring out some really, really interesting insights. One thing where I sort of started my research out was just looking at the opportunity that's there in Asia. And the crazy thing is, when you boil it down, what's the sort of driver for food in a particular region? It's just people. Because the more people you have, the more people eating things. And in Asia, there's going to be another 250 million new citizens by 2030. That's like the population of Indonesia, which is like the fifth biggest country in the world by population size. So, you know, there's 4.5 billion people across Asia who are just going to be eating more and more food. That's a huge tailwind. And then where things start to get interesting is trying to work out, well, what are the preferences of these 4.5 billion people across Asia in the way they want to purchase food, the way they want to consume food? All of those things manifest itself in these businesses, such as delivering food to the door, in-store digital payments, much more seamless, healthier food options, alternative meat options. So this is a really good, I think, entry point into just looking at food tech in general.
Yeah, and there's so many layers to that. Like when you say there's going to be, you know, 250 million more people eating food, when you start to segment that around, you know, class divide and socioeconomic status of those people, you start to segment that around like urban versus local versus regional, mm-hmm. and like how you distribute food, like different nutritional needs, you know, the experience of dining, the, you know, the speed of delivery, like how they get, you know, food from A to B, the supply chains, you know, agriculture. Like there's so many lenses to how food is produced and distributed in Asia that we could cover today. And, you know, this probably warrants an episode in each of these verticals. So hopefully we can do this justice.
All right. So what's one of the unique things you found about either Western companies in Asia, or what's the differences that you're seeing? What's one we want to dive into start with?
Yeah, I think let's first talk about, you know, traditional franchises based in Asia. I guess where I want to start, Dan, is like when you were living in Indonesia, like were there many food chains there, like on the ground? How did you find that?
Yeah, there was a bunch, and they're all definitely American. You know, KFC is one of the first ones you'll see when you touch down in Jakarta outside of the airport. There were some which were like, just from an Australian perspective, quintessentially American that we don't have here. I think it's called like Big and Western or something like that. You had Pizza Hut. So you have all of the sort of common American franchises. What was interesting to me is as I was looking through some of the reports, company reports of these companies in Asia, they're very aware of this category. So I think it's Pizza Hut in China. You know, they call themselves very specifically in a category of Western casual food. So, you know, as we are in Australia, you know, we go out, we're going to get Chinese food, we're going to get Italian food, etc. The flip of that is in Asia, they've got this concept of like Western casual food. And where that really sort of plays in is things like steaks or high quality meats, things like pizza, which is a very sort of fast food, quintessential Western food. And also family dining, because the price point does tend to be a little bit higher compared to more local foods. So the idea is it's more of that sort of like family experience. You're taking everyone along. It's a different concept. Like when I go to Pizza Hut here in Australia, I don't necessarily consider it as like, you know, the family dining experience, but in Indonesia it is. And they have a much broader range. And this is a point I'll get into again later. Like they don't just have pizzas, they've got salads, they got steaks, they got all of this different stuff, far outside the range than what you'd find in the Western counterpart.
Yeah, it's so funny that you say that and you talk about the broader experience of going to like a Western casual restaurant, not a fast food outlet. Because there was this great quote that I found. It's like, all Asian food is already fast food by nature because it is created very quickly. Mm. And so the role of fast food or like Western fast food has really changed in Asia to be more like, you know, like a family restaurant or a particular type of like, let's try this Western food in the same way that, you know, we would go try like, I don't know, like Italian food or Turkish food. Mm. By going to a particular restaurant, like that is our experience of eating a different cuisine rather than just going for something like, you know, quick and dirty.
Yeah. Yeah. And all of these franchises, I think they've been in Asia for a long time and they're picking up some of this feedback and data. One of the things that really astounded me was, and I know this is maybe pivoting slightly off where we were, Albert, but one of the clear differences between a KFC in China, for example, and a KFC in Australia is their digital presence, digital sort of innovation. KFC in China has got 305 million members. Like, they have 159 million app downloads and 62% of their sales are member sales. You know, so that just gives you an idea, one, I guess, the scale of China and the opportunity there, but the idea that they're just getting so much information on every single one of the consumers that go through their door. Compared to Australia, like, I'm not a member to any of these fast food sort of chains or anything like that. 85% of KFC China's orders are digital orders. Their delivery sales growth is 3x from 2017 to 2020. They've got this whole private domain on their app where they've integrated WeChat groups, Alipay, TikTok, all these different things. So you can sort of talk with people, you access promo codes, see the latest deals. There's just a whole ecosystem there, which we don't have in the Western counterparts. And I think if we're going back to like, what are the drivers behind all this? It's just the sheer scale of people that are going through their doors compared to like some of the Western counterparts.
Yeah, I think the scale is such a good call out, and it's scale in a completely different way, that it's like that it's customer scale rather than necessarily like a restaurant scale. I think if I go back to one of your initial comments and what you've just said around, you know, when they first launched, they became really popular. You know, I was reading the history of KFC, and one of the things they did when they first opened was they opened right across from like a Chinese franchise called Glorious Fried Chicken or Glorious Chinese Chicken or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, Glorious Chinese Chicken was cheaper. It was larger portioned. You know, it was like Chinese run, so it wasn't like new to the block. But KFC attracted a lot of customers away from Glorious Chicken for like a couple of particular reasons. The first is like it's a social sign. So it's like, going to KFC was a sign of, you know, wealth and prosperity, and so people went there instead. The second was hygiene, and this was a huge competitive advantage for companies like KFC, McDonald's, Starbucks, Domino's, etc. As they moved into Asia, was hygiene and food kind of like safety was a big competitive advantage because they had all these like playbooks and rules, regulations internally as to how they like clean their restaurants that really position them to win a lot of customers. And I guess the third one was like quality and taste. Like when you go to a McDonald's restaurant, everyone knows this, you go to Macca's, KFC, anywhere in the world, it's going to be the same every time.
And
that was something that for a lot of consumers who hadn't been to a franchise like that before, particularly as, you know, companies like KFC and McDonald's enter new markets, had a necessary experience, which is you're going to get the same meal every single time, which isn't necessarily true when you go to something more localized. And so those are key three things, the social proof, the hygiene, and the consistency, despite it being more expensive than other players, lent itself to a huge competitive advantage in the Asian market.
This is a great entry point to talking about some of the differentiators in the Asian market across countries, while also sort of keeping this idea of like, well, what drives consumers through the door? And you mentioned a couple of things there, but you mentioned like taste, quality, freshness, cleanliness, etc. The most persuasive sort of research that I found, I think, summed it up as the number one determinant for these sort of consumer habits is value for money. And the reason I really like that is because that doesn't mean the cheapest is going to win. It might mean that, you know, consumers are more willing to pay the higher price as long as they can see, you know, the cleanliness, the standardization, the other things that have gone in behind it to make it more valuable for that particular price. And then when you use that as a paradigm, it's really interesting to see how countries split. So when we think about value for money, the more developed Asian or Oceania countries, Japan, New Zealand, Hong Kong, Australia, because I think there's already an assumption that goods are fresh, goods are pretty good quality, et cetera, they are much more price sensitive.
Yes.
So price is the driver of their decision.
Really, really good call out. Yes.
When you go to countries like Indonesia, Thailand, Myanmar, Singapore, freshness is the main determinant over price. So customers will see a product, and even if it's more expensive, if they perceive it as being fresher, they're more likely to purchase that one. And I think that's because they see that as better value for money. There's sort of all these associations, connotations with freshness. And that's an interesting split to sort of think of, and then how that manifests itself in some of these big franchises, how they position themselves, their products and advertising.
Yeah, I want to hold that thread because I think we'll come back to it when we start talking about like food tech and innovation in the space. But the other layer that you add on to freshness is quality. And so this is, I'm going to use Kobe beef as an example, and then we can talk about this later, is you've got different grades of Kobe beef, but it, where's the social proof and the actual like stamp of approval that says this is this particular grade, this is this particular grade? Because I remember going in and eating Kobe beef in Japan and it was good, but I was like, how do I actually know this is the grade that I paid for? And that's also another challenge. But I want to talk about that when we talk about food tech. But, you know, I think that insight from you is absolutely true. I think the other thing I do want to talk about is the inverse, which is like domestic-based chains in Asia. So franchises that started localized to a particular country in Asia who've either expanded within Asia into other countries or overseas. I think the question I want to pose, Dan, is like, when you were in Indonesia, again, similarly, like, was there an Indonesian-based chain that you really liked?
There were a few. There were a few. And what I found interesting researching for this episode, Albert, because I was trying to look at publicly listed companies because they've got public reports, you can access, etc. So hard to find Asian-located publicly listed company. And then I asked myself, well, why is that? And it became pretty obvious pretty quickly. What's the incentive for some of these companies to go overseas? They've already got a huge market on their doorstep, which they know, they're familiar with, et cetera. Why, like, if I'm a Chinese company with 1 billion plus people to feed, why am I looking to go out into the Philippines or somewhere else like that, Indonesia? It's, I think, a really interesting characteristic of these Asian companies that there's no big incentive push for them to go out there. When you look at their American counterparts, when you look at, you know, those numbers I mentioned for KFC China, that's the reason so many Western restaurants are seen in Asia and not the other way around. I want to turn it on you a little bit, Albert, though, because one of the ones I did find, an Asian franchise which has sort of expanded out, public listed, Jollibee, Filipino fried chicken. Can you give us any insights on them?
One of my first true loves, Jollibee. Jollibee is this incredible fried chicken chain franchise that started in the Philippines and now has expanded out to a number of different countries, you know, including the US. But the core of what they do is they have this like incredibly tasty seasoned fried chicken. You know, boned, unboned, comes in burgers. You can buy it fresh. You know, you can buy it just to eat, and it often is served with rice. Yep. And so this is like probably very analogous to like KFC with rice, except they tend to be more focused on like chicken wings, and they tend to be more about like a rice dish rather than like a burger franchise. And Jollibee is an incredibly popular Asian restaurant because it capitalizes on the love of fried chicken in Asia. You know, there's a lot of different types of fried chicken, like Taiwanese fried chicken, Japanese fried chicken, you know, Korean fried chicken, etc. Like fried chicken is, you know, I probably should have done a more digging into why that is, but it's a huge staple in Asian cuisine and really capitalizes on that. The second is like quite a fun brand. Like it's like a bee, which is their mascot. It's like red and yellow. It's like I used to go to like kids' parties growing up in the Philippines, like I was trying to work out who owned the license in Australia for Jollibee. And I'm not sure if it is Justin Hems, but last time I heard on the rumor mill, it was Justin Hems who owned the license to Jollibee in Australia.
Wow.
And so, you know, incredibly popular. I can definitely foresee it coming into Australia at some point, given the big Asian population in Australia. But I'm really surprised it hasn't pushed further and further into the West.
I really like that last sort of throwaway comment that you mentioned there, Albert, that as, you know, the Asian population in Australia is increasing because we have such a big migrant population here. I think over 50% of Australians now have, you know, a family member or parent who was born overseas. That to me is a driver of now Asian penetration into Western markets. Because I can think of, you know, the international student experience. You go overseas, what's the one thing you're sort of craving? It's home cooking, something that's familiar to you. And now, you know, before maybe you had Panda Express, which isn't really home cooking, but now you might actually have a local chain which has expanded overseas. And what to me is very clear of that in Australia is all of the bubble tea chains that have just cropped up. I mean, that's a recent phenomenon. That's the last 10 years. When I started sort of university, maybe a little bit before that, there was those limited. In Sydney, obviously, you had quite a few. But then now you've got like a Char Time on every corner, everywhere. It's just, you know, a huge burst in that particular sort of product.
Great call out. And I'm not just going to say just bubble tea, because the bubble tea has just like, I don't know what it is. It's almost become like a weird cuisine zeitgeist. I actually don't like bubble tea, but everyone I know loves bubble tea and like just powers through that stuff. I think the other thing I'd even layer is just like the random Asian dessert chains. Like there's the yogurt one. I can't remember what it's called now, but that's, I think it's Taiwanese. That's kind of permeated through Sydney and Melbourne as well. And no doubt has also done the same thing in the US, even if it's not the same franchise, but the same product. And I can really start to see, because competing in Australia around Asian cuisine is so difficult. Like you've got a lot of the localized players who already do it, like the restaurants that
you know, mom and pop stores.
Yes. Yep. And then you've got, you know, some of these franchises that are slowly started to come out, like, you know, Hong Kong Express and whatnot. And then you've got everyone else who makes food. It's very hard to compete. So where the wedge is for a lot of these companies who are moving from Asia into Australia is either beverages, where there's a big history of, you know, beverages and beverage companies from Asia entering Australia, like Asahi and all their umbrella brands, Suntory and all their umbrella brands. But also desserts. I feel like desserts are a really big one that people really underestimate. How quickly that can permeate through Australia, especially due to like the Instagram-ness of the desserts that they have in Asia.
Okay, I'm going to make 2 points on that, Albert, before I think we pivot. One, on the dessert front, really interesting. What I've seen out of KFC in China and less so here is very clear in their strategy is we're going to make TikTokable desserts. And I think if we can pull out, you know, here's an example of the difference between the Western counterpart and Eastern. The Eastern counterpart seem very aware of social media and how to leverage that to get more consumers, more customers. Whereas, you know, I think in Australia, at least from what I could observe, it's still very much like TV ads, those sorts of things, YouTube ads, et cetera, but like not, what do you call it? It's like an organic interaction when you have people themselves sharing a photo of their dessert at KFC as opposed to KFC paying an ad to go out.
It's not like paid distribution. It's like, exactly. We love this product so much, we're going to share it organically.
So now I want to sort of pivot, Albert, to the food tech side of things by talking about sort of an observation of that conversation we just had there, which is behind all of these brands is a supply chain. Is things which can be optimized to really help a business, particularly restaurants and food where margins are pretty thin. And what came to mind when we're talking about Asian companies penetrating into Australia and Western countries was what happens in the infrastructure business where I work, where like Korean companies, Japanese companies, there'll usually be one big manufacturer like a Samsung or something, which goes into a new market like Indonesia, gets the first contract, and then all of their suppliers and stuff from Japan can start slowly working their way in. It's like they set up a beachfront. It's like literally like an invasion in the other country, and they can start to like expand out more and more space for their local players to come in. And if you think about like the first bubble tea chain to open up in Sydney or in Australia, you know, they had to work out how to get all of their ingredients in, supply chain, all of their equipment, which would have been unique to them, through the door. Once that first started establishing in Sydney, you know, the next bubble tea place would have had a much easier time, and the third place had a much easier time. You start building up economies of scale, so now your costs are cheaper. This is an area which can really be optimized by tech and innovation. So where do you want to go to with this conversation, Albert?
Yeah, great, great call out. I look at the high level, I know we've talked about this before, but the life cycle of the value chain of food. So it starts at obviously like production. I think we had a really good conversation about this in our Zomato episode, and Zomato is another company I'll reference now. Like production of food and then like delivery of that food. So that's that initial supply chain around how you get fresh ingredients to restaurants or food producers or manufacturers. And then moving from that, you know, processing of food. And then this is further supply chain, how you get either processed food out the door to grocers, restaurants, how you get, you know, ready-cooked meals out, how you get food delivered across from a restaurant to a consumer. So there's a lot of things here specifically to supply chain that I want to double-click on. But I really want to start at the very, very start, which is like food production and the growing of food. And, you know, there's a lot of agricultural areas in China in particular. But I want to move away from traditional animal-based food and talk about like alternative sources of protein.
Okay.
Because you've got 250 million people to feed. How do you feed these people sustainably? And then how do you ensure that there's like a supply chain that can do that? And the key things I want to touch on are, you know, plant-based meat, cultivated meat, and then insect-based meat.
Okay, Albert, you lost me at insect-based meat, but let's give it a go. I'll just provide some context before I really want you to sort of let it rip and dive into it. There has been some research into plant-based meat in Asia. It's expected that that market's going to increase by 25% from 2020 to 2025 and up to 200% in China and Thailand. And generally, like, you know, in the Asia Pacific, 75% of consumers are willing to pay for plant-based meat if the price is similar to that of regular meat. So there's, you know, there's not necessarily an apprehension towards alternative meats. In fact, there's a lot of drivers in terms of being perceived as healthier and better for you. So Albert, with that sort of context there, you know, generally people, consumers are in favor of alternative meats in Asia, but what's going to really turbocharge this transition to different foods?
Yeah, I think you're right around the scale. It's like, can you manufacture either plant-based or cultivated meat at scale for a cheaper price point? And when there's so many people in China competing, you often just end up competing on price unless you've got a really differentiated product. So that's the key things is, can you lower the barrier to entry for someone to shift away from, you know, meat to plant-based meat? And I think China is a really good test case because tofu is such a big part of their diet. And tofu they're already used to eating kind of like soy or plant-based produce as part of their diet and then cooking it in the same way that they would meat. So the barriers to education are quite low. I think the added layer I would shift and add on top of that is that China, there is a really big push around kind of climate change and environmentalism in China. And that's another kind of really big effort that is pushing, you know, and driving plant-based and lab-grown meat in China.
So one of the things you mentioned there was the sort of the cost barriers to entry. And this is a really important point because when we think about the chain of where are the opportunities for food tech innovation, yes, you can have all these different players trying to create alternative meats, you know, this lab over here, this lab over there, et cetera. Very, very inefficient. And there actually are players looking to make innovation in this space. There's SG Protein, which is a Singapore sort of based manufacturing platform. And essentially their premise is they're going to allow companies A, B, C, D to use their facilities, almost like a WeWork, I guess you could say, to test their manufacturing of meat alternatives and then get it out to market. Because you can imagine the equipment they need to use is very, very specific, very technical, et cetera. So rather than them bearing all that upfront cost, let's spread it out across over multiple sort of manufacturers or people trying to make plant-based materials or alternatives. And, you know, you just sort of get this, what would you call it? It's like almost not like a network effect, crowdsource. It's to me, it's really, really clever. And that's the sort of innovations which are happening in the space.
This is the kind of insight that I was really hoping that we could unsurface by having an episode like this, because I think you're absolutely right. Like tinkering in the lab with different proteins and experimenting to make, you know, plant cultivated meat or shifting away and using, you know, soy and other plant-based materials to create meat is a completely different game to manufacturing and producing food at scale to feed the, you know, the billions of people who live in Asia, or you know, the 250 million people who are going to come. So I'm really glad that you've actually got this example, Dan, because it's like food manufacturing as a service that we don't, or plant-based food or cultivator-based food, but it's a core competency that a lot of these startups are trying to build and don't necessarily have yet. And it's not something that someone has done, at least from my vantage point, in Australia. So I think that is a super interesting call out.
And now I'm just trying to think of the parallels. It's like, well, we've got all our episodes we've done on computer chips and semiconductors. It's the exact same premise where you've got NVIDIA, super successful at designing these chips, but they don't have or don't want to actually manufacture them. And so they send them out to another company, TSM, et cetera, who will do the manufacturing. Because food tech, I think, is still quite immature, it doesn't quite yet have those layers where you can build up these efficiencies and cost savings.
Yep. I think the other thing I'd add is we talked about Beyond Meat quite a while ago on this pod, maybe even a year ago now.
Yep.
But if you think about Beyond Meat and everyone, they compete Impossible Foods. Like, they're such a behemoth business now, Beyond Meat. Like, the last thing they would want is to be sharing a manufacturer, even if they think their product is far superior. But that's actually what the case is with computer chips. Like, you share a manufacturer in TSMC, but you're still competing with a bunch of other people they manufacture to. It's funny to see how that mindset that we always come back to even plays out in emerging industries like food tech in Asia.
Did you have any last points on alternative meat sale? But I've got one on 3D food printing.
No, that's also interesting. Please dive in.
Well, so the interesting case for it is aging population in Asia. So obviously we're talking about the increasing population, but, you know, a downside to that, particularly in places like Japan, you have a huge aging population. And that means that food has to be more personalized and actually needs to be sort of nutritionally targeted to the needs of their consumers. And the idea of 3D food printing is, you know, it's not necessarily going to be pretty, but like astronaut food, you can have these gels, these mushes, which can have all of the nutrients, et cetera, that you need. And you can really tailor the nutritional value of it. So they found that you can 3D print chocolate, for example, in a way which reduces its sugar content, but keeps sort of everything else the same. And I just think that's like a really interesting prism to think about how we're going to be eating food in the future. Because honestly, there's people in aged care facilities in Australia that are getting pretty bum meals at the moment. You know, not a short step to move to things like gels and paste, et cetera, particularly if they're cheap and particularly if they're giving people a really good nutritional intake for their day.
Yeah, I think it also kind of solves some of these manufacturing and distribution challenges, because there are 3D printers that can 3D print at scale, and 3D, you know, you see things like 3D printing houses and things like that. And so, you know, food manufacturing is a different game. But when you've got this technology that's been around for a bit longer, you can probably do it at scale easier.
Yep. All right, Albert, what do you want to hear next?
Look, I think, you know, as we kind of wrap up the pod, something that we talked about quite a bit with Zomato was cloud-based kitchens. And they actually acquired a very interesting business recently that builds these automated robotic cloud-based kitchens that really only produce a particular type of food. So they're completely automated robotic machines. There's like very little human intervention required. But they can only produce like pizzas or different types of burgers and things like that. And something that we have talked about is, you know, cloud kitchens, which is people rent out a kitchen facility space, make a restaurant, and then just sell that restaurant or sell their products through Uber Eats. But the challenge then is like you're still paying staff. In Asia, they've even taken that a bit further, which is they've got a kitchen space and that's actually just filled with robots who are manufacturing one type of food at scale, and then they push out through Zomato.
Yeah, I mean, that to me is a really interesting proposition, because it makes so much sense, right? Like initial innovation on the restaurant, particularly due to COVID, was, well, we're paying for this customer space where people would eat, dining space, which we don't need to. So if we cut that out, as you say, Albert, put people in sort of a just kitchen facility in sort of a warehouse somewhere, we're saving on costs. The next innovation on that is, well, let's get rid of the staff and put in robots. And Albert, I would consider the next innovation on that is, well, why doesn't Zomato just have that in-house? You know, why don't the big Uber Eats delivery players just own that supply chain? You could really optimize then the locations to the drivers and all of that data that you're using. To me, that makes so much sense.
And you just keep abstracting away the headcount as they've done, right? So we've abstracted the way away, you know, like front of house or, you know, wait staff by being in a cloud kitchen. We're now abstracting away the chefs, or maybe you'll have one chef who helps kind of train these machines and the initial ingredients and make. And then let's abstract away the delivery staff, which we have, you know, already started to see. Like, yeah, you've got drone delivery. You can potentially automate a lot of delivery in the future. Let's just keep abstracting away. So it's a completely automated food delivery service that's run through like a cloud kitchen.
Where I want to return to with this interesting conversation of mine is back to the original question of, like, you know, what's the difference between Asian or rather Western companies coming into Asia for food and vice versa? Do we think this is something, as I think our thesis has been across a couple of episodes, that Western counterparts are going to start emulating the East or the Asian? Or do we think there's something particular about the demographics, consumer preferences, the sort of population sizes, which means there's still going to be this gap and divergence in the way these businesses are run?
Good. It's a really good question. I think there's going to be a convergence, definitely, where a lot of these solutions have been built to address a couple of key problems around, you know, food delivery and distribution, around localization versus urbanization of food. It's like, you know, Uber Eats, there's very prevalent in Sydney. You go out to, like, I don't know, like Wagga Wagga or something, you know, Orange, you're probably not going to get as many Uber Eats options. And so that's a problem. If you live in, you know, rural Australia, you just don't get as many good food options. And then lastly is just like the quality of food. And so those are like the three big challenges that Chinese, if you live in China, you live in, you know, Southeast Asia, you really feel. But if you still feel those problems, just not to the same extent in, you know, a country like Australia, and you definitely feel it in the US, which is obviously much bigger than Australia. So I definitely think as food gets more expensive, and then you'll layer on those three dimensions, like the things that are happening in China that are solving those problems are definitely going to happen here.
I agree. I think my caveat there is, to the extent that the problems are the same, and, you know, as an example where it might not be the same is, you know, you're in Australia, much lower population density. The idea of these cloud-based kitchens just might be more unworkable. You know, it might just be a fact of the location that it really is only cost positive when you've got, you know, like a million people within a kilometer radius, which some of the big cities in China have compared to Australia. That to me is sort of interesting. But again, and maybe this is us with confirmation bias, Albert, as we've looked at some of these Asian companies, or even just Western companies operating in Asia, it feels like they're 5 years ahead of the game. And, you know, let's go to our final verdicts, Albert. For me, the thing that stood out the most was just how integrated KFC, Pizza Hut, et cetera, in China and Japan have got an awareness of their customers through digital integration, and then pair that up with social media. That to me is a no-brainer, but it is not happening, at least in Australia, and I don't think it's happening really in the West as much to the scale as in Asia.
Yeah, and we could have had an entire episode of talk about this. Like, we still didn't talk about, like, McDonald's and BTS having a collaboration and that driving, like, this influencer-based marketing in Asia. You know, we didn't talk about, you know, the different types of food tendencies and why pizza has become super popular in Asia and, like, what's driving that. Like, I think you're absolutely right. Like, there is a particular capability set around who your customer is in Asia that is so much more mature than in Western countries.
Is that your final comment, Albert?
Yeah, I think this is an interesting pod. We'll probably go eat some like tasty Asian food today now that I've been thinking about it.
No Jollibees in Australia yet, Albert.
Unfortunately not.
All right, Albert, let's finish up there. Thank you for listening to Fresh Capital, a podcast about companies and investing told in a refreshingly simple way. If you're not already, support the pod, rate us 5 stars, follow us, all the rest. It really helps us out. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Fresh Capital. Every week, we provide a refreshingly simple way to learn how companies operate and how investing works. Just a reminder, all information contained in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, financial, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Fresh Capital are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Any opinions expressed in the show are not recommendations or advice. Please consult a licensed financial professional before you jump in. As always, we look forward to seeing you next week. See ya!